Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast, brought to you by the World Retail Congress. I'm delighted that this episode is sponsored by Alex Partners, and with me in the studio is Matt Clark, Partner and Managing Director. This episode forms part of a series with Alex Partners that we're calling Disrupt or Be Disrupted, looking at why the old retail business models are no longer fit for purpose. To highlight the new retail business models, we're going to be meeting and chatting to some great retailers who are helping reshape retailing and who have been in the middle of managing constant change and disruption. Matt, hello. Good to see you.
Hi, Ian. Great to be here again.
So our guest today, very much looking forward to meeting, is Judith McKenna, the former president of Walmart International. Judith has close to three decades experience working with Asda in the UK and then with Walmart, and has now recently joined the board of Unilever as a non-exec director. So Matt, I mean, what strikes me is this gives Judith a really powerful perspective on how retail has been disrupted over the time that she's been in the industry, and also how companies such as the ones she's been involved with have had to adapt to that.
Absolutely spot on, Ian. And I think I'm really looking forward to this conversation because, as you say, Judith's experience having very senior leadership positions in the largest retailer on the planet and having to counteract, respond to, adapt and adopt to all of the disruptions that have gone over the last sort of 20 or 30 years, she will have a fascinating insight into how large retailers who are sort of weighed down by their legacy systems and ways of working have managed to react. And of course, Walmart, great examples of reacting very positively to these disruptions. And I also know that that Judith has a particular passion for the people element of this and how to lead people through these disruptive times. So really looking forward to getting an insight on that. I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy the discussion.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. The strategy is one important thing, but having the people all leading in the same direction or going the same direction is absolutely critical. And the size of the organization she's been involved with, it should be fascinating to hear what she's got to say. So let's get on and introduce Judith. Hello, Judith. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
Good. Judith, I said in my introduction that you recently stepped back after many years working at Asda, then Walmart. I'd love to know how you're finding the change of pace. Are you enjoying the different approach to life and work?
Yeah, it's 27 years in total that I was at Asda and Walmart, which is quite extraordinary, really, especially given I only actually meant to join for a year. So having got to this milestone is incredible. I am thoroughly enjoying finding out a bit more about life, being able to travel a little bit more and not just take photographs of monuments outside of car windows and just exploring different things. And things like this, it's great to do because I get to understand a little bit more about what's happening in the world broader than Walmart and Asda.
So I guess in a similar way, we're looking forward to this conversation with you because you're able to have a bit more of a helicopter view of the retail industry, and we'd love to get your views on it. And really starting because this podcast series is looking about disruption in the retail industry and who's disrupting and how retailers should respond. And love to get your views because whenever, certainly I talk, and I know Matt as well, talks to senior retailers, the common view is that this is probably the most challenging time they've ever faced in their careers. So love to get your perspective on that, whether you would agree with that statement.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. That said, I would also tell you that I've probably never come across a retail time where we didn't say it's really disruptive or this year is going to be really difficult. You've had those conversations every year. But I think there are some things happening at macro level and in a retail specific world that does make this more challenging. You know, world politics, global trade routes, all of those, there's more fragility globally than there has ever been in our lifetimes. That's for sure. So I think that's one backdrop. And then you had the recent, you know, inflation, interest rates and happenings there. And then go to the other side, and we've managed to get less than 5 minutes into this without talking about technology and the changes that technology are bringing as well. And we've seen the rise of disruptor business models in a way that they've always been there, but the fact that there is more access on a mass scale for them, I think, is one of the things that is different. So undoubtedly, this is a challenging time. And the fundamentals of retail remain the same, But I think it's the backdrop in which we operate in that is different to how it's been before.
Yeah. You mentioned disruptor models. I think that tees that Matt up nicely to really get to the heart of, you know, where we see disruption going.
Thanks, Ian, and hi, Judith. Great to speak to you today. And as you know, the series that we're doing is really focusing on six disruptive themes and trying to help retailers think through what that means for their individual businesses, what they can adapt or adopt from some of those disruptors, or indeed how to defend against them. And very quickly, you know, the summary of those disruptions are the sort of next generation of discounters, which of course you'll be very familiar with in the grocery scene. The retail, real-time retail trends are using data science and intelligence to really be able to influence and track consumer behavior, but also run businesses more effectively. The consolidation of brands onto either strategic or IPCO, OPCO type business models. The whole rise of circular retail and the need to both deliver that for consumers, but also how to do so in a profitable way. The rise of retail media and other services that retailers are using to make best use of the access to consumers they have. And then finally, the social selling and how that's changing the way brands and retailers access consumers and increase the opportunity for D2C brands to make better connections. I just wanted to ask you, really, of all the disruptions that you've seen, whether it's one of those six or others, what would you see is the most exciting or perhaps even the most challenging thing that you've seen in recent times?
Yeah, it's a great list. And I bet the big challenge that you had as you put it together was how to get it just to six. Because there are so many things coming together at the same time. And we could all reel off different pieces and different things to it. I think it's back to this. Everything coming together at the same time that creates some of that challenge. And for me personally, what's really interesting is the contradictions in some of the ways that retailers need to respond. So, you know, think about it, the rise of data, you mentioned retail media, the rise of data, the amount of data we have now, many businesses are omni or online, with the need for trust, like, more important than ever in the world for consumers to know that you're trusted. But at the same time, they want personalization. So how do you do that? How do you do personalization, which is generally machine AI generated, and at the same time remain human with an empathic connection to your customers so they connect with you on an emotional level as well? You know, another one, think about the role of value to consumers. Like, there is a bit of a flight to value happening, bifurcation, no doubt at the top end, very much so, but this flight for value. At the same time, people are more conscious than ever about where their products come from, how are they made, are they sustainable? You mentioned the kind of circular economy, those two parts. So we want a circular economy because that's good for the planet and good for people. But at the same time, I want value. So how do you navigate that as a retailer? I think the other ones that are happening out there, Matt, are, you know, everybody's now got the message that omnichannel is probably the way forwards. It was interesting listening to one of your earlier podcasts, even there, a pure online player saying, actually, omni, the experience in stores is really, really important. So how do you do that and have a viable business model? Because there's no doubt that when you start to introduce, particularly for a bricks and mortar retailer, more online elements, you're delivering to people, you're getting them picking up at store, that economic model is not the same as it was previously. And then finally, I think there's this contradiction in workforces, which is at a time when we need people who are more skilled because roles will become more skilled because there are different types of roles out there. You have a generation that not everybody in it wants to work in the way that perhaps we did as we came through and grew up. So I tell you all of those more of a, I think what the challenge that retailers face is navigating the contradictions. And that's where great leadership has to come in. You know, you have to decide who you are and where you want to play, or you could end up getting caught in endless loops of what if this or what if that.
I love the way you describe those contradictions. I think that's a really great way of summarizing the challenges that retail leaders face today. And I'm sure we'll come back to some of those specifics in a moment. But perhaps before we do, I was going to ask you, in terms of your experience sort of running, you know, large parts of the largest retailer on the planet, how did you face into those challenges, and how did you work out how to manage the contradictions yourself when you're looking after such an enormous organization?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I wish I had a perfect answer to that. Some of that comes down to who Walmart is. So it has a deeply embedded purpose. It's there to help people save money and live better. And when you have that, it gives you a North Star about thinking through all of the things that you need to do. Where are the lines in what you do and what you don't do? It has deeply embedded values as well. But what's really interesting for the business is I've watched it over multiple years, particularly over the last 10 years, as it reignited its innovation ability and to really step forward. You know, Walmart in its history was one of the very first companies to really lean into technology in the retail space. It introduced satellite links into all of the stores. So for the first time, you could broadcast to every store. I mean, it was unheard of. And in fact, there is still a satellite dish sitting out to the back of the home office in Bentonville as kind of a testament to that, which most people just wonder what it is. But that's the history from what that was. And then maybe as time went on, less so from an innovation perspective. But as you saw the rise of competition, as you understood and had a leader like a Doug McMillon, for example, that things would need to start to change, it created a momentum within the business. And that's really how I've always tried to lead. And it comes from, are you a student of the business and of retail? Like, are you out there looking at what's new? Are you seeing what's possible? Are you thinking about it in terms of, is this something that solves a customer problem? And are we positioned in a place to be able to take advantage of that? And I'll give you the biggest example of that for me was online grocery shopping. And we'd clearly done it in the UK. We did it at Asda. I ran it while I was at Asda. And we'd had a couple of failures because we started with dark stores, as lots of people did, and then realized actually the key is stores. Fast forward and get to the US, and there was no concept of that. There was a few specialty businesses doing it. What was interesting to look at, though, is here is a nation that drives through. A drive-through in the US is like that. You expect it from pharmacy to coffee. Because there's a space to be able to do it in much of America. And at the same time, you had Walmart with a retail footprint that gave access to 90% of the US population within a 10-mile drive time. Like those two things together. So we started to say, well, how do we do online grocery here at scale? As that began to take hold, other people in the organization were, oh, actually, that's tech. That's clever. It's combining tech. What if we did this? And what if we did that? So it starts to shift the mindset of the business. And I think I was reading an article this morning about drones. Like if you told me 10 years ago that this evolution would get to Walmart is one of the leading businesses in the US, and actually we're using it globally as well. Flipkart in India, for example, are doing this, is using drones to deliver. Hey, I wouldn't have believed you. But the DNA of the organization, I think, has shaped and changed because there is leadership in particular, but also people right through the organization that are saying, what is the customer problem? What is out there? How do I bring the two together? So it's not innovation or technology for the sake of innovation or technology. It's to solve a problem. That's incredibly galvanizing.
And at the heart of that, the North Star, as you call it, the purpose, that presumably is what drove all of that right through that process.
Completely. Because, you know, we save people money. There is a value aspect to that, which is also time. Because that plays into being able to live better. And if to give you choices about where you shop, how you shop, and what you shop, and some of the most, you know, that is the beauty of the omnichannel models, and people around the world are running it very successfully, is it gives customers choice. And at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do.
It's interesting when you talked about how Walmart embraced online and created that omnichannel model, which probably wasn't called omnichannel then, but I remember thinking, just made me think back to that period. And, you know, Walmart, as Matt said, the world's biggest retailer then and now. That's a huge shift and what the way Walmart embraced that. And many, many retailers were still grappling in many ways with what is online, how does it fit in? I mean, can you think back to that period? How big a change was it in the business, and how the leadership team at that time grasped that and had that vision, I guess, of where how important it was in the business?
It's a really good reflection and question, Ian. So at the time, when Doug became the CEO, I moved into the US business and I had two roles. The first was look after the neighborhood markets, which were the small stores. Now, a small store is 35,000, 45,000 square feet. So for many people, that's actually a big store. However, it was very similar to the Asda footprint. So I knew them well. And the other thing is, could you have a look at this intersection of digital and physical and see what's in it? And at the time, it was less of an intersection. It was more two lanes just going in complete parallel to each other and not coming together. And you will both remember the mantra of stores are dead. Like, forget it. You don't need to put any money into stores anymore because everything is going to happen online. You know, 80% of the world's retail will be done online. I fundamentally believed, as did many people, and partly because I'd seen it in the UK, with UK retailers and the success that you could have, particularly for grocery from picking from stores, that that just wasn't true. And I wasn't alone in that. There were, you know, multiple people that believed that. And we started, like, it's back to give us a chance, let us do this, let us start. And in fact, just this year, the very first drive-through collect that Walmart created, which was here in Bentonville, about a couple of miles from my house, closed because it was a drive-through. It wasn't associated to a store and do those things. It doesn't matter that particular, and it was actually modeled on Leclerc in France. We'd been to see it and modeled it back to this, be a student of retail, see what you can see, bring it back, give it a go. The fact that it didn't work doesn't matter. We learned so much. And at the same time, we're doing pick from stores. That was kind of the start. At the same time around then, of course, the business got really serious about online e-com, not just grocery, everything else. And it was a coming together of those pieces. And I can remember we used to have a separate app for grocery and one for general merchandise, which got shipped to you, because we couldn't figure out how to put the two together. We didn't want to slow one or the other one down. Like, really smart people now have combined it together, and you couldn't possibly imagine it ever being different. But the practicality was we didn't have any choice, but we didn't let perfection get in the way of some speed and getting going. So I tell you that because just getting the business to understand it's okay to try things. It doesn't matter if you fail. And then the other one is we learned to be good partners to people. So I'll come back to my drones. Like, we're not building drones and developing them. And send, like, we have two partners. Wing Up is one of them, who, that's their speciality. That's what they do. So using people like that, automated cars, self-delivery, self-driving cars, same thing. We're not going to do that, but we partner with people who do. That creates excitement and energy in an organization. And people teach you things all the time.
And just, I think it was a great description of how you've adopted online grocery and managed to avoid the profit destruction that was very evident in the UK market in particular. What other really valuable disruptions or trends did Walmart adopt? What would be the other things that would be most notable in your tenure And how is that manifesting itself now going forward?
Yeah, I think if you look around the world, just watching what some of the global trends were and how to respond to them. Come back to the e-commerce area. We operate in China. And watching the speed in China of going from anything that was delivered, you know, was cash on delivery, very small and nascent, to within a period of about 5-6 years to being a complete ecosystem of operating for retail, connecting online with payment, with your life woven into the fabric of digital, was something that we took really seriously. And I think that's been fascinating to watch. Similarly, in India, you know, we invested in Flipkart, pure play, e-com business, with also a payments business called PhonePe there, watching the rise of payments enabled by rails that the government put in place called UPI, United Payments Interfaces, and how incredibly digital that nation has become really quickly. And at the same time, learning from this nimble, agile, pure e-commerce business, we brought a lot of those learnings back and back into the business as well. I think like everybody, we're watching the, you know, repurpose, reuse, recycle, like that part of it, and trying to see who are doing things there that are scalable. For us, globally, like you do need to think scale. Like, how can I scale this? Because the impact we can make when we do is incredible.
And maybe you mentioned that whole recycling, the whole reference to the circular economy. Maybe come back to one of the contradictions that you pointed out a moment ago, and this sort of value versus values contradiction, if you like. So the fight to value versus people's desire to see products made in a sustainable way, et cetera, et cetera. And that kind of, I guess what we see a lot of the time, and I'm sure you have done as well, is that with a few exceptions, the majority of consumers, you know, the whole ESG agenda is very much about share of voice rather than share of wallet. And therefore, the emphasis is on corporations to drive the agenda, rather than, you know, relying on consumer demand to drive the agenda. So I'd just love to your perspective on that, and how you see the role of corporates, of retail, of the industry, in taking accountability for that whole ESG agenda, and how that you see that playing out over the next few years.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one for me, because there is a business imperative around, let me give you one, surety of supply chains, which is nothing to do with kind of whose voice is loudest. It is that in umpteen years' time, supply chains are going to become under increasing pressure because of climate, because of crop issues, diseases that are coming through. Like, all of these things are putting pressure, particularly on food supply chains. So I think there is a business imperative about the planet, you know, and that involves to fashion and everything else. Like, you know, the more that we pollute, the more there are issues that there are. So I don't think it's a case of whose responsibility is it. I think it's an imperative that I think every business has to be thinking through. And the beauty of really thinking it through is nobody can do it on their own. You can make a difference as an individual retailer, an individual supplier, an individual travel company, and it, like, you pick what it is. It's when you join up supply chains to look at new and innovative ways, collaboratively, where possible, of taking out significant amounts of cost, pollution, you know, gigatons of gas, greenhouse gases out, that it starts to make a difference. So it comes back into, for a Walmart, being woven into who you are. Like, you can make people's lives better, but it also makes complete business sense to lean into it as well. So I think one of the areas that I'm most excited about as I look around the world, and it's one of the things I now have a little bit more time, I'm actually doing more digging around this, is, you know, thinking about the way, whether it be agriculture is changing in terms of different methods of doing agriculture. You know, while I was traveling the world more recently, you see the hydroponics, you know, there's a lot written on that. That's fascinating. And then just before I moved on from Walmart, the team had a partnership with a company called Ruby, which is, and they've started a trial, which will run for about a year, which takes CO2 emissions from factories and can turn them into fibers, which can be used for clothing. Like that kind of thing. Like somebody, when the team came and first told me about it, you're like, no, don't be ridiculous. You can't do that. But you can. So this innovation in supply chain and the different areas, I think it means it doesn't have to be an either or. It's not easy, but it's got to be an and, because there is no other choice but to do that.
And in a business the size of Walmart, how huge it is, how did it embrace innovation like that? Because that's, again, something that many, many big businesses, medium businesses, fail to do, even if they want to, they seem to fail to embed startups or innovations into the business. But it sounds like there's a culture within Walmart to do that.
Yeah, we didn't wake up one day and go, oh, do you know what? This is what we're going to do. Like, that's not how it happens. It happens over time. And it's incredibly easy to lose it. Remember, I talked about history being, we were incredibly innovative, then got less innovative, and then that acceleration curve changed again. So you've just got to keep it front of mind. And I keep referring to this student of retail, but I guess curiosity is what it comes down to. And we had a sourcing team who go out and they'll talk to anybody. Hey, what have you got? What are your ideas? What does this look like? Is there an applicability? Does it solve a problem? Like, a great idea looking for a problem is probably a challenge. A problem looking for a solution is really helpful. And if you can instill that mindset into the business, so this is my problem. What are all the possible infinite possibilities to help solve that? So I think a lot of it does come top down. A lot of it does come top down. And one of the great things, of course, about the World Retail Congress, Ian, is that it gives people a chance to come together and hopefully hear about what some of those things are. And that might just spark a germ of an idea for somebody to go and do it. And easier said than done, which is, don't be afraid to fail. I told you the story about that first drive-through here in Bentonville. There's been multiple other things that we've tried as well that just haven't worked. And the beauty of a world where there is more data, where you can do things online, is that you can take a few more risks and experiment in a way that when we were pure bricks and mortar, it was incredibly hard to do. But as I used to tell the team, you do a trial in one store, like, you're not going to disrupt the business model. We'll be fine. Just remember to take it out if it doesn't work, you know, which is always the challenge when you do this. So that thing, there is something in the approach and the attitude and the DNA of businesses. I'm often asked, how do you change culture? Like, how do you have a culture of innovation? And the answer I give is from something I read years ago, which on a book called The Oz Principle, which is, there's a, I'm aware I'm on a podcast and I'm doing hand signals to triangles to you, which is making me laugh anyway. But imagine a triangle split into thirds. And at the very top is culture. In the middle is beliefs. And at the bottom is action. And we all say we're going to change a culture. We're going to have a culture of innovation. Well, the way culture is created is by the beliefs that people have. Do we believe we're an innovative company? And are we looking for ways to be innovative because it's part of who we are? You get belief by the actions that you see around you. So actions, I'm seeing people being innovative. I'm seeing them having success. I'm seeing them try something, not failing, and they're not losing their jobs for it. I'm seeing people celebrated when they do something and it's different. And then people building on it. That creates belief, which ultimately can create culture. So dead easy for me to say it. Really hard to do it. And for a small or a medium-sized business, the benefit they have is they can move quickly. And that doesn't matter. Scale allows you to invest in more things. There is no doubt about it. And many of these things you can start doing and getting a flywheel working, and one thing will lead to another. Or, as we said earlier, do it through a collaborative approach.
That's interesting. So culturally, how do you stop thinking like we're the world's biggest retailer? Because that could be a real sort of hamstring, couldn't it, in terms of you stop to think about the scale of it. But to achieve that level of innovation, culture of change, that's a really interesting dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's always been the Walmart way, which is don't think about being the biggest. Like, you just can't. When I first moved into Walmart US, yeah, I come from Asda, which is a big business. It's a big business. And I moved into the US and I sounded like I was a parrot on repeat, because I was like, how many? How much? What? Because I couldn't comprehend scale. But it just means you have to keep it more simple. That's all it is. I just knock a few notes off the end. Imagine you're not that big. Imagine you're actually small. What would you do? And that is an incredibly challenging discipline to keep. But I do think it's been at the heart of Walmart's success. It's humility and it's refusal to think big, but to think best and to stay humble about that. And as we've expanded around the world, that's remained true as well. And you staying true to your roots, staying true to your values, helps keep you on the right path. I will tell you the story of when I first went into the US. And they used to give me these things. I used to literally sit with a piece of paper and knock notes off, because I couldn't figure out what the numbers were when there were so many notes on them. It was far easier for me to comprehend this in the units that I was more used to, because it doesn't actually change the decision making. And you know, sometimes scale, you have to think smaller, because otherwise you'll miss things.
That's great, Judith. I love that image of you knocking doughts off. As you now sort of move into your plural and non-exec sort of world, what sort of advice would you give leaders in retail? What sort of things would you say, well, you really got to focus on 1, 2, 3? These are the big watch outs, the big trends that you see that people really need to pay attention to and take into account as they look forward from where we are today.
Yeah, maybe to not start with the obvious, but it's obvious to me, is people. If you are a omni-retailer, number one, the experience that people have in your stores matters hugely. The experience that they have, the speed with which you get them in and you get them out, the way the product looks, and more importantly, how your team is. Are people greeted with a smile, with good service? Do they feel welcome and warm when they come in? Is it somewhere you want to go back to? And I think in the world of technology, and we've talked about some of the challenges there and what's happening, like it's going to be massively disruptive. Like, there is no doubt about that. Going back to remembering what the basics are and making sure you don't lose sight of those is equally important. And one of the areas that I worry most about is having enough people to do the work that we need to do in supply chains, in stores, in for deliveries. Technology helps that. And there is by nature high turnover in retail in many parts of it. But it means that the skill sets of people are going to have to change. And how do you retrain, reskill, and retool people to be fit for a future world? So that is one of the things that I sometimes worry comes to the bottom of the lists of things that retailers do. And I'm sure 99.9% of retailers do talk about it every day. It just doesn't usually make it onto the agendas when we do some of these things. And then the other one is this theme, which hopefully you've picked up, which is stay curious. Get out there. See what's happening in the world. Don't confine to whatever four borders you have, whether that be in your industry, in your country. Like, go and see what's happening. If you can't travel, strangely enough, there's this thing that, you know, you can see a lot of things online. So just make sure you immerse yourself, because ideas come from all over the place. And you might just see something that's happening in Japan that you think, oh, that might have some relevance to here, or this looks like that here. That would be it. So stay curious and engage your team in it. One of the things that I found as we were going through some of the transformation work was the more the teams right through the organization believed in it and understood things, the more traction that you got, because it became normal, not here's something over here that's happening and it's happening to us. It's much more, we're part of this, and that's a good thing. So that piece of it as well. And then my final one, again, we've talked about, is surety of supply. I think it's a massive, massive long-term challenge for the world, not just for retail, but it tends to, you know, come to a point with retail. So are you leaning as much to energy, how energy is working in your organization, than you are to, if you've got a large language model that's helping customers do something? Hey, that is the challenge of being a retail leader. It's a fantastic industry. It's brilliant. Wouldn't be in any other kind of industry, because almost everything touches the business model in some ways. And the challenge for leaders is, what do you prioritize? And how do you get to what's important? And the answer to that is, you have great teams.
To come back on the people aspect, because it's huge, as quite rightly you said, and you're worried about the retraining, the skilling of the workforce. Are you also worried about the ability of the industry to attract people into the funnel, into the first place, into the entries? Historically, always been difficult to attract people. Is that something that's become harder, do you think?
Retail is incredible, because it is one of the few professions in the world where you can get into this with absolutely no qualifications, no background. You can rise through and have a phenomenal career. It's one of the things that I love about it, is the opportunity that it creates. But it's still not always perceived as being a really glamorous career to go into, and those pieces. I think the job of retailers is to make the work for the people who are in retail better. And I think that's where this connectivity between technology and business can come in. So we at Walmart use one of the first models we started to do with AI was to help figure out what stock needs to come from the back to the front using computer vision, looking at it on the store shelf, in the warehouse shelf, and saying it's that one and it needs to go there. And it probably needs to go at 4 o'clock. Like, that ability to help people have better jobs, I think is really, really fundamental. I could do a whole another podcast on that, because I feel really passionately about it. If the jobs are great and good, there are career opportunities, we train people well, then I think that more and more people will be positive about entering the industry as well. And that's got to be something that everybody thinks about.
And Judith, you're obviously uniquely positioned to see the differences between how this plays out in the US versus in Europe, given and indeed the whole world, given Walmart's reach and your history. How do you see regional differences impacting what leaders should be doing, how people are impacted by some of the things that you've just described? What have you observed over the years, and how do these disruptions and how do the reactions to the disruptions play out differently across either side of the pond?
Yeah. I always have to be careful when I get asked questions like this, Matt, because the chances are I'll offend somebody by something that I say about one set of people or another set of people. Because there are differences. There are differences in retail. Grocery retail in particular is slightly different, you know, and some of that's practicality. So when I went into Walmart's first, I was like, the packages are huge. Well, that's because people have big fridges. That's not true in a China. So people shop every day as opposed to shopping with us. So there are undoubtedly cultural, practical differences around the world in consumers and in businesses and in work practices as well. But I will tell you that having spent so many years traveling the world in retail, people are more alike than they are different. Like, people have the same hopes, fears, and dreams. They want to be treated well. They want to be able to take care of their families. They want to be served with a smile. You know, they want to be able to get what they want when they want it at a value that they can afford. All of those things are true. And that enables businesses to leverage, by the way, which is a great thing. But I think keeping that in mind, no one is more disadvantaged or advantaged than anybody else in this. The one exception I will tell you to that is where there are interventions from governments or legislation that changes slightly opportunity or creates more challenges. And, you know, I'll give you the example in India again of a government-created payments system that businesses could use meant the interoperability between businesses became much more smooth and much more capable. And that can change it. But the fundamentals are still the same.
Please, you mentioned India again, because you've mentioned it a couple of times and you know the country really well through Flipkart. And as a student of retail, how are you viewing India? It's a market that so many, over the years, people have said, that's the place, it's really exciting, but the infrastructure isn't there. But honestly, it is the country I'm hearing people talk about a lot. And how is it the new China in the sense that that's where some really exciting things are happening in your view?
I love India. It was a huge chunk of what we did, but we'd been in India for a long time. And then we did the, with cash and carry, just 26 clubs. And then we did the Flipkart deal. I think this is India's time. This is a Judith view. I think it is India's time. I think there is infrastructure being put in, both physical infrastructure and digital infrastructure, at a pace that I don't think I've ever seen a country be able to do that. It has an incredibly demographic favorability in terms of its people and the sort of how young people are in that market. And it's a country of entrepreneurship. It always has been. They have taken quite a clear position in terms of making India not only coming into the future, but more and more indispensable to the rest of the world. So if I think about manufacturing coming out of there, the investment into that as well, it's incredible to watch. So I'm really optimistic on India, which is probably what you'd expect me to be, given the fact that we invested in it. But I do think even over that time, I see more and more positivity. And I think that's why you've got the interest and why you're hearing so much about it, Ian, is as people see challenges in China, and we have a business in China that's fantastic. But equally, if people aren't there already, that's harder. Where is the next part of population growth coming from? Well, India is one of those areas. And that's why I think you're seeing so many industries, like right across the board, go there. It makes me smile when I read either LinkedIn or see something and, you know, there's industry leaders doing India and seeing it. And so people should. They should learn from it and understand it and the uniquenesses of it. And back to what we said earlier, the things that are the same.
Judith, I think we're coming towards the close of our conversation. It's been incredibly fascinating. I mean, would you mind just summarizing, so your key pieces of advice for the retail leaders that will be listening to this podcast? What are the sort of top three takeaways that you would give to retail leaders as they continue to navigate these sort of turbulent times and look forward over the next couple of years? What would be your sort of top three takeaways?
Whilst you're looking at all of the new, don't forget the fundamentals of retail and how you operate well in all aspects. Secondly, go out and see the world. See what is out there, not just in retail, in other industries that may have relevance, in partners that may be able to bring something to the table. And thirdly, you have, as a leader in these times of challenge, you have to be resilient and working on your own resilience in order to be able to do all the things we talked about for the last 40 minutes is incredibly important. And the dictionary definition of resilience is not just the ability to withstand shocks, it's the ability to adapt to change. And I think if there is one trait that I would say to leaders today, it's work on your resilience. Like, what is it that helps you personally and your teams be adaptable to change?
Judy, I think we could go on talking for a lot longer. It's been fascinating and we have to draw it to a close. But to close it, you're going to be joining us in Paris for the World Retail Congress, which we're really looking forward to. As you know, our theme is high performance retail, and we love to ask our podcast interviewees what high performance retail means to them. You've touched on many things. So I just would love to conclude this interview with your thoughts on what does high performance retail mean.
I think it is a retail businesses for the future, which serve customers brilliantly well, take care of people, look after the planet, be part of the fabric of communities and society. High performance retail moves at speed and it takes people with them and it keeps customers right at the very heart of it. So I'm looking forward to hearing more at the conference about how that translates for different people in different parts of the world. So thank you so much for inviting me to do this. And I'm really looking forward to Paris.
We're looking forward to seeing you there. And thank you again for your time. This has been absolutely fascinating. Loved it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Judith.
Thank you both.
So, Matt, wow, that was a masterclass in retailing, I felt. Got to ask what your takeaways are from that.
Well, Ian, I agree. It was a real tour de force of all those topics that both the disruptors and just general retail leadership kind of bring to life. And I guess, you know, there are many things we could touch upon that Judith mentioned there, but some of the things that really resonated with me were this, you know, stay curious, be a student of your business, be a student of retail, and continue to look outside to see what people are doing elsewhere in the industry and outside of the industry, and really sort of engage with partners and understand what the new and exciting innovations are, but continuously connect that to the needs of the customers and how do you solve customers' problems. So not innovation for innovation's sake, but actually very directed to solving customers' problems. I think that was a really good connecting point, I think, between the curiosity that's required, but also the customer focus.
And that collaboration and partnership to get those ideas and work with your suppliers, I think that was really, really telling. And for me, it's just, I suppose, being reminded, I hadn't really thought about it. Just when you think of the scale of that business of Walmart and just the way Judith talked about what happened and the things they're doing, you know, retail media, they're huge in now. Omnichannel, they really changed that business. And it's to turn a business around and be that curious and innovative, that's it's quite something, isn't it?
It is quite something. And I think Judith obviously spent a good portion of the time talking about the sort of culture, the agility, and her point about actions driving beliefs that drives culture, and the need for leaders to stay resilient and adapt was clearly born from the experience of getting the largest retailer on the planet to change at pace, which I'm sure was extraordinarily challenging in a business of that scale. And I think it's a great, great lesson for others. And if Walmart can move at that kind of pace, then, you know, I'm sure others, more smaller, more nimble organizations can adopt that as well. And some of the larger ones. So yeah, I think the how to part of that conversation was extraordinarily powerful. And in particular, of course, Judith's passion for the people agenda really, really came through well, and how to continue to both attract but also reskill and retool people within organizations so they can adapt to the challenges of today's market. I thought that was a super important point that I'm sure many people are dealing with and grappling with, but a very good perspective on how to go about it.
And I left her a summary of what high performance retail means to her. It felt like a clarion call for the whole industry, because you could, the simplicity of that message of what it is and what retail needs to be as it moves forward is great. So I think she teed it up nicely. Matt, thank you for joining me. Really enjoyed that conversation with Judith, and hope everyone else enjoyed listening to it. Thank you again, and see you very soon. Thank you for listening to the World Retail Podcast. If you'd enjoyed listening, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music for more. Thank you for listening.